I'll quote here, "When you understand that true accountability is about choice and taking ownership of your choices, everything changes. You move from resistance to empowerment, from limits to possibilities, from mediocrity to greatness." How do we get started on this journey?
We always have choice. And yet, I think for too many of us, we tend to look outside ourselves. We're waiting for someone or something to change, which means we're really giving away our power to create the results in the life we want to live. And so I would argue that in the end, we choose our consequences by the choices we make every day.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money, how to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Brian Moran. He's a co-author with Michael Lennington of the New York Times bestseller, The 12-Week Year. He's the president and founder of The 12-Week Year. He has 30 years of expertise as a corporate executive, entrepreneur, consultant, and coach. His background positions him with a unique skill set to help individuals and organizations grow and prosper. Brian is a recognized expert in the field of leadership and execution. His realization that most people don't lack ideas but struggle with effective implementation led him to the development of the 12-week year. In addition to his books, Brian has been published in many of the leading business journals and magazines. He's a sought-after speaker, educating and inspiring thousands each year. Brian lives in Michigan with his wife, Judy, and their two daughters. Today, we talk about where the idea for the 12-week year come from, how effective execution can make all the difference. We don't need new ideas to double or triple our income. Applying what we already know can be enough. Short-term goals and long-term vision, ownership of your choices, and true accountability. Results are the confirmation of greatness. You become great long before the results. The importance of breakout blocks, as in rest. And last but not least, we'll hear about Brian's own measure of success. Here's one of my favorite quotes from the book. "On the daily, weekly basis, the difference between greatness and mediocrity is small, but the difference in results down the road is tremendous." Please help me welcome Brian Moran. Hello, dear listener. I have a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, please follow, subscribe, and most of all, share with everyone that would like it too. It's all word of mouth marketing. It's all up to your fingertips to make a small contribution and become an important part of the success of the show. Thank you. Welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Hey, how are you, Bogumil? It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining me. As I mentioned to you, I read your book more than once, and it had a huge influence on how I work, how I invest, how I write, learn, and everything else in my life. So I wanted to talk to you more, and I picked out a couple of things from the book, many of them really, that I want to dive in deeper. And I wanted to mention that even this very podcast went from an idea to scheduling, recording, and production in 12 weeks, so I can't help anymore.
I love it. Awesome.
But think in terms of 12 weeks. My wife said, "You need more time." I said, "No, Brian said I need 12 weeks." So here we are. But in my conversations with my guests and offline with clients, we start with money and investing, but we often talk about time. And we consider time our most precious asset. And your book is full of advice and ideas of how to manage our time. So I want to jump right in and start from the very beginning. Your book, The 12-Week Year, Get More Done in 12 Weeks Than Others Do in 12 Months. Where did the idea come from?
Yeah, interesting question. So Michael, the co-author, and I had been working with clients. Originally, it started out, you know, coming from corporate America, started on my own, just thinking about, you know, what's the value we're going to bring to clients? And kind of thought about the stuff we had been doing around some of the leadership and as well as some of the process reengineering and ideas and, you know, new techniques and things like that. And Bogomil, like, quickly realized that they all had great ideas. They all had all kinds of resources that they just weren't using. Really shifted to look at, okay, why aren't people executing? You know, what's keeping them from implementing more effectively? And so started working with the fundamentals of what it takes to execute at a high level. And we were getting good results, but we were still doing it in the context of an annual environment, like most people do, like probably most of your listeners, right? We'd set annual goals, build annual plans, we'd break them down quarterly and monthly and weekly. And we were getting good results, but we felt like our clients were capable more. We felt like we were capable more. And so we came across this concept called periodization, and we borrowed some tenets from it. It was like the light bulb went off for us, because we did notice that people perform better certain times of the year. And so we recognized that the annual environment was a barrier to high performance. And so we created the 12-week year to get out of the annual environment based off an athletic training process called periodization. So that's, it came about in working with our clients is the short answer to it.
In your book, you write, the barrier standing between you and the life you're capable of living is a lack of consistent execution. Effective execution will set you free. I think you just touched on it, but tell me more.
Well, yeah, everyone has great ideas. Everyone has resources that they're not tapping. And what I find for most people is they're off looking for new ideas. They're building more potential without actualizing the potential they already have. We use the example of, in the States here anyways, the fitness diet industry is a $200 billion industry, and yet most Americans are overweight or obese. Is it because they really don't know, or is it because they're just not doing it? And I find that's true in most areas of life, right? If people just did more of what they know consistently, they'd be healthier, they'd have better relationships, they'd make a lot more money. And so, you know, that notion of it's great, new ideas are great, knowledge is great, but the marketplace only rewards the knowledge, the ideas that get implemented. And so that's what really changes for people. When they learn how to execute, it fundamentally changes the results in their life in a very short period of time.
You touched on the following question I had for you about new ideas versus old ideas. We all keep looking for new ideas. We think that the secret is around the corner. And I just came back from an investment conference and we were talking about the technology and innovation. And you write something that I really paused and thought about it, because you write that your experience has shown that most people have the capacity to double or triple their income just by consistently applying what they already know. That's a very powerful statement.
Yeah, I mean, we've just with tens of thousands of clients, honestly, seeing it happen. The interesting thing about our book is Michael and I didn't sit down and kind of write about this theory we had. We actually just documented what we were doing with clients. So it wasn't, hey, let's come up with this theory and see if it works. we had figured it out in the trenches and then just documented it. And so we saw that time and time again that, you know, I mean, take anybody that's in business for themselves or in sales or something like that, and you take their best month last year times 12, it'll be four or five times what they did. And they would argue, probably rightly so, hey, there were some exceptions that month. All right, let's take the third best month, not even the second. It'll still be double or triple what they did. That's the capacity we all have just by being more consistent with the execution, as opposed to starting stuff, you know, letting it fall off, starting it again, chasing new ideas, looking for new stuff, right? The economy's turning and a lot of people are paralyzed right now. Some of them are just hunkering down saying, I'm just going to hunker down until we get through it. And goes back to normal. It's never going back to the way it was. And others are just throwing mud on the wall every which way. And so they're running from one idea to the next. It's like chasing rabbits. You've got to be focused. You've got to work on the implementation, the execution. And when you do, again, the results are profound, to be honest with you.
I think it's very visible in the investment profession, because there's no shortage of new ideas. And we've seen it with all kinds of innovation that sometimes fizzles out and disappears. But it's so appealing because the grass is greener. But if you actually pause and look at the things you're doing, if they're working and you just do them better, you can have much better results. I think that's the main premise of the book. You touched on it, the final weeks of the year, and I found it really fascinating because I see it each year in my profession, how people leave things until the last few weeks of the year, but that's when they want to meet the quotas, that's when they want to get business done, that's when updates, upgrades, everything happens. And you have this idea to repeat this rush of creativity and productivity that happens at the end of the year and do it over and over again throughout the year. Tell me more about this, and you touched on it already, but I'm very curious.
Yeah.
How can we replicate the final countdown of the year multiple times a year?
Yeah, ideally without all the stress, right? The problem in the annual environment is it comes with a lot of stress because there's so much on the line. And so we end up sacrificing sometimes holidays and family and sanity. And we sacrifice all this capacity we left on the table earlier. So, you know, Michael and I realized we had to get out of the annual environment. And that's where the 12-week year was created. And so, Bogomil, our clients work in the context of every 12 weeks as a year. And there aren't four of those in the year. That's annualized thinking. There's just this 12-week year followed by the next. And so if you think about, if you really embrace 12 weeks as the year and you're thinking, what does that mean in terms of your actions and your cadence and things like that? Well, it means, you know, you've got 12 weeks to make things happen. And so just like at the end of the calendar year, in the last few weeks of the 12-week year, you're probably even more intensely focused than you are the first few weeks. But what happens in the 12-week year is because there's shorter time frames, there's this healthy sense of urgency, not the stressed out urgency that people feel in October, November, December, but a healthy sense of urgency and more of the important stuff is getting done. So what happens in that, unlike the annual environment, is it actually lowers the stress. Because what we're not saying is, hey, take everything you do in 12 months and try and cram it into 12 weeks. We're saying, let's accomplish in 12 weeks what we do in 12 months. And that's about working differently. So it's really about being focused on the things that really move the needle and not being perfect with them, but just being more consistent with them. And when we do that, the stress goes down, the results go up pretty dramatically.
Are you thinking also in terms of a feedback loop that you don't have to wait 12 months to see what has worked, what's not working, and you have a chance to try again with a different set of assumptions or maybe even practices?
Yeah. So every week is an opportunity in the system to assess what's working, what's not working. So right away after week one, we know, because here's the thing, there's two things in play. One is the goals, which are outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I would argue we don't control those. The other are the tactics in the plan. Now, most people plan conceptually, so they don't have a tactical plan. But when you have a tactical plan, what happens is we begin to score the execution. We track the results. We score the execution, which in those two sets of numbers tells you everything you need to know. It pinpoints the breakdown. So you're able week by week to make adjustments. So the 12-week year is about making smaller adjustments more frequently. That's how you build the momentum. That's how you build the results. And you never go more than 12 weeks before we have a hard stop and we celebrate the progress and success. And then we look at what worked, what didn't work in a big way, what's changed in the marketplace, and we'll lock and load and go again. So it's a much more fluid process that gives us, as you're pointing out, more opportunities to adjust, more opportunities to learn, to figure out what is working, what's not working. When the marketplace shifts, we can pivot with it much more effectively than we can in an annual environment.
When people hear 12 weeks, they might think, oh, it's very short-term focused. But at the same time, in your book, you write about a long-term vision. So all those short-term goals lead to a long-term vision. And I'm very curious about your thoughts on the vision. And I see those 12 weeks as building blocks to something bigger. Sometimes when we make an investment, it might take us a couple of weeks to do the research, but then we hold it for 3-5 years. And I'm thinking how the two can coexist, both the short-term efficiency and the long-term vision. Can you talk about the vision? It sounds like it's something that keeps people going as they give up a little bit of comfort on the way.
That's right. Yeah. So we talk about, you know, live with long-term vision, act with short-term urgency. And it starts with that vision is so critical because that's the motivation. That's your why. Why are you willing to do these things? Why are you willing to try some new things? Why are you willing to step out in some areas that you may not have ever done before? And I would argue also, if you're going to create a better result in any of your life, you're going to have to do things you haven't done before. You're going to have to do things differently and do different things. And And every time we do that, there's a level of discomfort, there's some uncertainty, there's some anxiety. Without a vision of the future that's more compelling than the present, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. We tend to choose what's comfortable and what's familiar because we're wired for comfort. And so that vision is critical in helping us stay the course to go out into the marketplace and try some things. Because look, we part of the 12-week year is planning at a tactical level, and we're really good at it, but there is no perfect plan. Every plan's flawed to some degree. So you've got to go out there and you've got to hit and miss with it. And without a vision, what happens for people is when certain things don't work, they sort of throw up their arms and they go, oh, this isn't going to work. With a vision, you keep at it. You take the feedback, you adjust, you try again, you come back, you adjust. And that's really the process of succeeding. You know, occasionally we experience these massive breakthroughs, but most of success in life is about, you know, acting on something, then paying attention and making adjustments and trying it again. It's like Edison with his electric light, right? 3,000 failed experiments. Well, how did he know what to do in experiment number 1,400? because he did 1,399 and he paid attention and then he made a slight adjustment. And that's the way success is in life. It's about constantly adjusting. Why? Because the marketplace is changing too. You can be on top of the world today. You've seen this. And in a year, things have changed. And so it is a process of continual adjustments.
I have those conversations now and then with clients and fellow investors, then the life shelf of a business is so much shorter. So in the 50s, you would have the same companies among the top 10 or 50 for many decades. And now we have a major shift. The top 10 companies today and 10 years ago are very different. And even the ones today, every day we're hearing about new disruptors potentially taking their business away. So you have to continue to innovate or you risk being not relevant anymore.
Yeah, I mean, look at Blockbuster, great example, right? I mean, they were the leader in that industry, an industry that has totally been disrupted and they don't exist anymore. If they exist, it's like two stores or something, you know?
It's a very competitive world out there. And another idea from your book I find life-changing, and I'll quote here, when you understand that true accountability is about choice and taking ownership of your choices, everything changes. You move from resistance to empowerment, from limits to possibilities, from mediocrity to greatness. How do we get started on this journey?
Yeah, it's interesting you'd pick that out because that is such a powerful concept, and it's probably the most misunderstood concept. In that most people experience it and think about accountability as a negative thing. It tends to be affiliated and associated with negative consequences, right? Someone does something that they're not supposed to do. Someone in authority says they're going to hold them accountable and then they punish them in some form or fashion. So that's how we experience it. And that is not what accountability is, right? Accountability is not consequences, it's ownership. It's based on free will choice. This fact that we always, always have choice. And yet, I think for too many of us, we tend to look outside ourselves. We're waiting for someone or something to change, which means we're really giving away our power to create the results in the life we want to live. And so I would argue that in the end, we choose our consequences by the choices we make every day. And if there's an area that you're struggling, if you really dig into it, it's probably an area where you haven't taken ownership, right? You're waiting for something or someone. When you take ownership of that, you start to look at the choices you're making in it and the actions you're taking in it, things will change. Now, it doesn't guarantee things are going to work out the way you want them to, but it guarantees your best shot at having them work out the way you want them to. And so how you think about accountability affects everything from your health, your relationships, your income, your fulfillment. I mean, it is truly the most empowering concept when you understand accountability for what it is, which is choice, free will choice, and ownership.
It empowers people, it could, but it also gives them a huge responsibility. The responsibility is back on us. It's up to us to actually show up and execute or not. And I think it's an eye-opening way of embracing this idea. I like the word greatness that you use in your book. And the part that I like is that you mentioned that results are not the attainment of greatness, but simply confirmation of it. You become great long before the results show it. It happens in an instant, the moment you choose to do the things you need to do to be great. And it gave me chills when I read it. I thought about it a lot because we're waiting for the results to confirm that we're good at something.
Yeah.
But here you say it's also back to you. You made a decision to do something really, really well. And that moment defines the future results. Can you talk more about it? I feel like it's such a powerful idea.
Yeah, it's back to the fact that we don't control the outcomes. And when we look at greatness as a society, it's always based on outcomes. So there's nothing wrong with that. But the fact of the matter is the way you achieve those outcomes is through the actions. And so what we control are the actions. And so the notion of greatness in the moment is this notion that, you know, we don't have to wait to be great, because if we're waiting, it's never going to happen. The truth of the matter is all we have is this moment. Life is lived in the moment, right? 2 minutes ago is a memory. The future's not here. My life is lived moment by moment. It's like the hourglass I got sitting over here, right? The sand at the top's the future. God willing, we get to live it. The sand at the bottom's past. Where's life lived? It's one grain at a time, one moment at a time. And in order to create the outcomes, the way society would say you're great, you've got to do the things in the moment. So this notion of greatness in the moment brings us back to what we can control. Am I doing what I need to do to live the life I want to live? If I am, then I'm great, because the results will come. They're inevitable because I'm taking the action, not just once, but I'm taking it again and again and again, however many times I need to take it consistently to get there. You know, I use Michael Phelps as example, right? Those gold medals, I would argue that they weren't his attainment of greatness. It was really the confirmation of it, that he became great years before that, when he decided to do whatever he needed to do to get those kinds of results. And it's the same for you and I and your listeners, is that, you know, it happens moment by moment. And so, but there's a tendency, you know, we think if we're ever going to be great sometime in the future, our income's at a certain level, relationships look a certain way. You know, the truth is we're great in the moment, and either, or we're not. And either way, that's reflected in our future, whether it's around our relationships, our spiritual journey, our finances, our business, whatever it is.
You know the saying, chop wood and carry water. The idea is to fall in love with the process. And I think it's really important in the investment world, because there are ups and downs. But if you stick to a certain process, the results will follow. And as you mentioned, we don't have full control when the outcomes will be exactly the way we want them. You know, the stocks will go up this much or that much. But we have full control over how we pick the investments, how we do the research, how we treat our clients. So we have full control over the process. And that's where the greatness happens. Mm-hmm. And the results confirm it down the road. And I found it really eye-opening. You add in the book that the difference, the daily, weekly difference between greatness and mediocrity is small. So if you look closer, you might not even tell the difference. But then the results down the road are tremendous. Can you talk more about it? I found it really interesting how the divergence happens down the road, when the small changes, seemingly small changes, make a huge difference down the road.
Right. Yeah. I mean, think about someone in a sales environment, right? The difference between mediocre and great on a daily, weekly basis might be a couple more calls a day. It might be delegating the task instead of doing it myself. Things of that nature. The difference between being really fit and being overweight is not huge, right? Sometimes it's 500 calories a day or something like that. Over time, though, that makes a big difference. And so, you know, what's true about success is most of the success is driven by the daily mundane. Most people don't become wealthy because they had one great stock score. You know, they're not healthy because they went from South Beach diet to paleo to keto. It's because the way you get wealthy is you spend less than you make, and you invest the difference, and over time. The way you get healthy is you exercise, you eat right every day. And that's true in life, in every area of life, and in your business, right? It's the daily mundane. And yet that's the things people don't want to do. They want to find some quick solution. They want to find something that's more fun, more sexy, that's shinier. But I find that for the most part, your success in life is around the daily mundane, whether it's about building your marriage or relationships or being a better parent, right? It's not just about occasionally spending time with your kids. It's about spending hours and hours and hours with your kids, because that's when it gets real.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's very alluring that if the difference is so small, why not reach for it, right? You said a few extra phone calls. Or...
Well, it's the consistency of it though, right? It's the how many times you got to hit the rock before it splits. And most people won't do it consistently long enough. I think the other thing about most of the things you want to accomplish are going to take a longer, more sustained effort than what you think on the front end, right? You think it's going to happen in the short period of time, and it takes more effort than that to make it happen typically. And so the way our clients are able to accomplish more in 12 weeks than most did in 12 months is because they're focused on the highest payoff activities, and they're doing them consistently. They're not hit and miss with it. It's not one week they do it, the next week they don't, or 2 weeks on and 1 week off. It's every day or every week. And what happens in that is that's what creates breakthrough. There's always buildup before breakthrough. You know, one more done this week and one more done the next week and one more done the next week and one more done. In 12 weeks, it can make a big difference.
Maybe my brain is wired in a different way, but I find it very appealing because it's, if you had option A, let's climb Mount Everest in 2 weeks with no preparation. And the second one is, let's hike consistently every day. I find the second option much more alluring because I can see how I can make it part of my daily, weekly routine. The mountain, as much as I would like to be on the top in 2 weeks or overnight, I know that's likely impossible, right? So I find it alluring that what you're proposing is a little bit every day, and that a little bit every day compounds to a lot down the road.
Yeah, and if you did that hiking, appealing. Then you'd be prepared to do Everest. You know, the guys that go up Everest and aren't prepared are still up there, right? There's bodies littered on that mountain because they weren't prepared. But if you're prepared, you can do just about anything.
I think the way we talk about success in the media, we just talk about climbing the mountain, the last 5 minutes and the photo on top of the mountain. Less is talked about how did we get there, right? We see the person on the cover of the magazine, the third or the first, the top most, the richest person in the world. But we don't really see the day after day choices and routines and habits that the person chose to have. Speaking of choice that you mentioned, that led them to this greatness long before the great results followed. And I think it would be more interesting, but there's not enough pages in the magazine to to cover it.
Well, think about that. You look at lottery winners. Most lottery winners are broke within 5 or 10 years after winning the lottery because they didn't have the daily routines and the habits and the processes built in. To create that kind of wealth. And so when they get it, they don't know how to maintain it and build it. And same concept, really.
Preparation. Yeah, you touch on something very interesting because quite a few of our clients, they experience sudden wealth for one reason or the other, whether it was inheritance or sale of a business or a well-paid career. But having a chance to prepare for that compared to a lottery winner gives them a huge advantage that they can actually benefit from it instead of that being something that becomes a burden and the winnings or the wealth goes away very quickly. So I think that mindset of preparation before the actual summit, I think that can help a lot. There's another theme that you talk about in your book that I summarized as professional and personal life. And in many situations, we're taught to kind of keep them separate. But I personally grew to appreciate to allow them to collide and benefit from each other. And you talk about the vision and the aspirations, how they have to align, both your professional and personal. Can you talk more about it? They feed on each other, and you can be more successful in both if you find the source of inspiration and some sort of a balance between the two. I found it really interesting that it's not just the professional success, but the personal has to come along on that journey.
Yeah. I know for years anyways, there's a lot of talk about keeping, personal and professional separate and oftentimes having to sacrifice one for the other. And you can do that. I don't find that beneficial though, right? You're one person. And so be outrageously you in your personal life, be outrageously you in your work life too. And what I found is that if my personal life is thriving and my professional life sucks, that's not so fun. If on the other hand, my professional life's thriving and my personal life's a disaster, that's not so fun either. So our approach has always been holistic, right? Let's look at the areas that matter to us Right? Let's be intentional about it. And then let's work on those areas that matter to us. And the 12-week year facilitates that really well because, you know, I can work on my business and I can work on some of my personal goals as well, whether it be relationships with my wife and my kids or whether it be my fitness or whatever that is. And so this notion of balance, though, is a bit of a misnomer because I think it leads us, Bogomil, to kind of sometimes believe that we're going to spend equal time in all the areas. And that's not going to happen. Even if you could do that, I don't think it's going to create the kind of life you want. So we talk about intentional imbalance, just being intentional about, you know, what's important to you and where you're spending your time. And there's different seasons, right? When our kids were young, we did different things than we do now that they're grown and things like that. So I think it's really about intentional imbalance, which is where do you want to spend your time? Where is it most productive to spend your time? Recognizing that, you know, a one-dimensional is probably not healthy. So, you know, there are workaholics that go, no, I want to spend all my time at work. Okay, that's great. But man, you're missing so many other things. To me, work is just part of life. It's not life. And I love what I do. Part of the reason I love what I do because it empowers me to do things in my personal life that I love to do as well.
Very much so. Yeah, I like what you said, the imbalance. It's a compromise. It's a choice. But I think the two can benefit from each other. If you have a very happy personal life, you can have a happy professional life. And I think we're told, especially early in our careers, that one comes at the expense of the other. Mm-hmm. Work really, really hard. And eventually we realize it's not sustainable. And we're talking about exhaustion and burnout these days. I think it's really interesting how to find a vision that you can realize both sides of your dreams.
Well, look, none of us know how many days we're going to get. So this notion of work really hard and then you can kick back. I mean, I work hard at work but it's not all I do. It doesn't consume my entire day. It doesn't consume all my thinking. When I'm there though, I'm focused. I'm working hard. When I'm at home, I'm focused. I'm playing hard. So to me, just personal opinion, that works well for me. I've seen it work well for a lot of folks. The people that are one-dimensional tend to crash and burn at some point.
That's very true. You write about the importance of breakout blocks. You use the term breakout blocks. Working longer and harder kills energy and enthusiasm. We need regular breaks to refresh, reinvigorate our mind. So what I'm hearing is what you just mentioned, work smart, not hard, and rest in between. Tell me more. I find it really interesting, and I see as a theme that's coming up in more conversations of how do we manage our time in the way that there is time to rest.
Well, here's the thing about that, Bogomil. If you're doing what's really driving the results, then you're also going to create more free time. Like I have, I was talking with one of our clients, and he's going through our accelerator training program, and he's like, you know, Brian, I'm getting all the important stuff done by 1 o'clock right now in the afternoon. He says, I've got to be honest with you, I'm feeling a little guilty about all the free time I have. And so we talked about where's that coming from? And it's coming from because in the past, he used to kill himself, you know, past the dinner hour and still not get the results he was after. But he's working differently.
Right.
And so he's able to create the wealth and the money that he wants to work, but he's also creating more time freedom because when he's at work, he's focused, he's clear on what are the high payoff activities, and he's doing them consistently. Again, not perfect. And what it's doing, it's just driving his results dramatically in less time. This notion of, is it possible to make more and work less? It absolutely is. We've got tens of thousands of clients doing it, but you have to be willing to work differently. That's the key.
Being smart about it. I have to ask you about remote work and work from home. And this is a phenomenon that existed when you wrote the book, but obviously accelerated since, and the COVID 2-3 years really gave a chance to a lot of us to try it, people that have never experienced it before. And many of us are still working from home. I'm joining you today from home, and I'm guessing you might be home too. And I'm curious, has that changed the way we think about managing our time, the goals we set? We got a lot of time back. I have to say, you know, commuting in New York sometimes cost me quite a few hours. And these were very precious hours where my brain is the freshest, but I'm sitting on the train trying to get to the office. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that. Has that changed the paradigm a little bit or accelerated some things?
I think there's pros and cons to it, right? Like you said, the pro is, hey, you've gained this time. The downside is there's a lot less collaboration in terms of cultures and organizations. And a lot of people don't have the discipline to work at home. to be honest with you. They, mm-hmm.
They need your book. They need your book.
Yeah, they do. but you know, the truth is they're easily distracted. They don't have the routines in place to be productive. Right. When they were in an office, some of those routines are built in. They're forced on them, right? You've got to show up at a certain time. You work till certain time. There's certain breaks. There's specific things that happen. There's routines that happen, and there's structure in that environment that most people need. And so if you're going to be effective at home, you've got to think about what structures do you need to build around you so that you can be successful, so you can stay focused when you're at work and you can do the work you need to do. And then how do you collaborate? Because a lot of the collaboration doesn't happen in formal meetings. It happened in the hallways, and it happened mm-hmm. in the drop-ins, and it happened over lunch and things like that. And so all of that, when you're working remotely, goes away. How do you build that back in to your work week? Otherwise, we lose the benefit of all that, you know, that spontaneity, that cross-pollinization of ideas and thoughts.
The first part of what you mentioned, I'm thinking of accountability that we talked about earlier, that it's up to the individual to organize their day, because in an office environment, there's somebody walking around and telling you, this is the time for the meeting, this is the time to deliver this product, this project, this presentation. And here it's really a lot of self-discipline. And I think there are a lot of ideas in your book to put that in place. The collaboration part, that's an open-ended question. I find it really interesting. How do we implement that in the remote world? I noticed that quite a few firms that we follow, that we know, they've hired people across the country or even across the globe in the last 2-3 years. So they expanded their hiring beyond the zip code, and they have to integrate new people that are not able to ever commute to their office regularly. So I think it creates more opportunities in that sense, new talent, more flexibility. But some of the things are harder to replicate, or we have to think of new ways to replicate in terms of collaboration and those random moments of interaction between employees. I think the virtual world has some catching up to do.
Yeah.
But I'm curious where it goes.
Yeah.
I like to ask about success. What's one of the questions that come up in my conversations? And I'm curious about your measure. I know that you measure your year in 12 weeks. I'm curious about your own measure of success. How do you know that you're on the right track, or how do you know that you're arrived? Speaking of greatness, both in the process and the results, how do you know?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I measure success a lot by, am I living the life I want to live in every way?
Yeah.
You know, do I, from a material aspect, from a non-material aspect, probably more non-material than material, but that matters to me too, right? Do I have the home mm-hmm. I want? Am I able to do the things for my family that I want to do? The education for the kids, we're into horses. We have horses, you know, some of that type of stuff. Am I able to do that for my family and for myself and have those experiences and have those memories? We're big on family identity. And so, you know, for me, that success is it's holistic. It's much more holistic than it is how much do I have as net worth. I mean, I track that. In my business, we're driving towards specific outcomes, revenue outcomes and impact outcomes and things like that. But that's not the only measure of success for me, right? I don't measure it simply by my net worth. It's, you know, my mom and dad never had a lot of money, but my dad was incredibly successful because he loved his family. He served his family. He was admired by, at my dad's wake, at his funeral, there were guys that came up that I'd never met that told me my dad was their hero. Never met these guys. Never knew it. You know, that's the kind of influence my dad had. That's a successful life, you know, having that kind mm-hmm. of impact. And so I measure it a number of different ways, really.
I was recently introduced to a concept of obliquity. It's the idea that you reach your goals in an indirect way. Just to give you an example, companies that obsess about a profit or some financial measure may push the costs too far, or they may overcharge the client and not end up really maximizing the profit. But the company that indirectly reaches that by, for example, focusing on the client experience and how the client is treated, are they getting the services they want, might actually maximize the profit ahead of the one that's focused on the profit. And it's similar with happiness. You know, everybody says, I want to be happy. Happiness is something that's very hard to pursue directly. tying back to what you were just talking about, or, you know, life satisfaction, fulfillment, and all that. And there are indirect ways in pursuit of other interests. So if you like horses, happiness will sneak up on you, but you are not approaching it directly. Have you thought about it this way, as an indirect way to achieve goals in life and in business?
Yeah, I think about it a little differently, probably same coin, different side, but I think about the happiness and success typically comes when you're less concerned about you and you're more focused on how to impact others, how to make a difference for others, whether that be in helping them be more successful, be healthier, whatever that is. But I think we're at our best when we're focused on how do we contribute to others. And then when we do that, the success follows, because people want to be around that. They want more of that. And so your example of the company that focuses on profits, profits are a byproduct of creating some value in the marketplace. And so if you get overly fixated on the profits, now what happens is you're not creating the kind of value in the marketplace to drive those kind of, you want to drive crazy profits, create crazy value in the marketplace. You want to create crazy happiness in your life, create crazy happiness for other people. And to me, that's where the joy comes from and the success comes from.
I love it. Brian, thank you so much. I learned a lot. I really appreciate it. And I would send the audience to your book, 12 Week Year, to explore some ideas, because it's a book that every time I read it, I find something else. And I was very glad we had the chance to sit down and talk about some of those ideas that have had a big influence on how I work, invest, and operate every day. So I big thank you to you.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's been a joy.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seekard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.